Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to talk about the ugly mess of conspiracism and derp and infighting that is plaguing the House of Representatives and will continue to do so for at least the next 2 years. We're going to talk to Paul Waldman from the Washington Post about that. And then we'll be joined by Erin Reed, who writes about LGBTQ issues and other stuff on her Substack, Erin in the Morn. And Erin is going to give us a rundown of all the vicious, intrusive, anti-transgender legislation that red state legislatures are wasting public resources pursuing. But first, I have a bit of a pet peeve. There was a piece in The Atlantic this week, a good piece, by the way, by political scientist Brian Klass. It was about conspiracy theories warping our politics. And the thing that I appreciated about it is that Klass didn't try to both sides of this problem. His headline was "Asymmetrical Conspiracism is Hurting Democracy." And his thesis was that, and I'll quote him, "In the past decade, conspiratorial thinking has shifted from a worrying factor in Republican politics to a defining feature." It's good that he sees that while obviously there is a degree of conspiracism on the left, across the ideological spectrum, this is a disease that is only really plaguing one of our major parties. You have to really stretch to see this as a both sides issue, which, by the way, many pundits have tried to do. I reviewed a book, maybe 10 years ago by Jonathan Kay. He's a conservative Canadian columnist, but a normal, sane conservative, as they have in Canada. And he balanced all of these crazy right-wing conspiracy theories with his example of similar things on the left were like Paul Krugman claiming in the New York Times that the U.S. invaded Iraq to guarantee its oil reserves would remain available to the West, which is hardly the same thing. And he did talk about some that were, when he wrote it, certainly theories that kind of transcended ideological boundaries, like 9/11 conspiracy theories. There were a lot of people who embraced those on the left and the right. Anyway, on the right, what we're seeing right now is conspiracy theories animating everything, right? There are always, it's all a conspiracy theory. There are always shadowy forces coming for your guns. Conservatives are being repressed by big tech, by the media, by blah, 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 by everything. There's always, you know, the World Economic Forum is in it, is in trying to reset this global government, blah, blah, blah. And certainly the idea that liberals are intentionally changing the demographics of this country through immigration is now mainstream in the GOP, and that is a theory that causes a lot of violence. And then you have like just a constant stream of silly nonsense, like the, you've probably heard the conservative saying that school children are being given cat litter boxes because they're identifying as cats, right? It's just stupid stuff. There was a story out of Texas this week. A Texas Republican introduced a bill in the infamous Texas Ledge that would make foods containing material from aborted human fetuses, quote, clearly and conspicuously labeled. It's a labeling requirement. Right. And I'm sure that guy saw some nonsense on Facebook about, I don't know, how your cornflakes contain aborted fetuses or whatever. And he believed it because they have been conditioned to believe all sorts of nonsense. They've been conditioned to believe that the so-called liberal media is covering up all sorts of outlandish horrors, crazy, crazy stuff for years and years and years. So when something comes up that is just, you just say, how can anybody be dumb enough to believe this? They believe it. So my pet peeve here is, this is just something I see on social media. My pet peeve is with people who look at how these conspiracy theories from like Pizzagate to the so-called Great Replacement Theory to the ubiquitous claims that LGBTQ people are grooming children into sexual abuse. people look at these things and they say, Jesus Christ, these people are going to get someone killed, right? They look at this and they say they're going to get someone killed and they just don't care. And I mean, you know, and just in one sense, of course, that's right. But it's a pet peeve because the people who propagate this kind of conspiratorial worldview have already been responsible for so much death, right? So many people have been killed and maimed as a result of this stuff. And acting as if that isn't the case downplays the severity of the threat. And you can go back, you know, I don't know how far you want to go back. You can certainly go back to see this in the militia movement of the 90s. I mean, I think you could go back a lot further than that to the kind of anti-communist stuff. But in the 90s, they were animated by all sorts of crazy beliefs about not only the Clintons, like murdering people in order to usher in communism, but also they had the black UN helicopters hovering around waiting to destroy America. They were going to replace it with a global government. You had this this environmental agenda, Agenda 21. They had all these conspiracy theories about that. And, you know, they blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, killed over 100 people, a bunch of children. More recently, of course, you had QAnon adherents. They've murdered a number of people. Six people died as a result of the January 6th insurgency of dunces, which was obviously inspired by a notably stupid conspiracy theory about the election being stolen. That same conspiracy theory inspired a unhinged Republican candidate out in New Mexico, a guy who lost a local election to conspire to shoot up Democratic lawmakers' homes. Fortunately, nobody got killed in those assaults. In 2018, 11 people were killed in a mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The perpetrator was convinced that Jews, headed by George Soros, were engineering mass immigration to America in order to displace natives and gain permanent control of the government. A year later, 23 people were gunned down in a Walmart in El Paso. That perpetrator was also hopped up on white supremacist great replacement theory stuff, nonsense. And that was also the case with the mass shooter at a Buffalo supermarket last May, right? There are a lot of examples. Lots of people have died as a result of this shit. And yet the right keeps pumping it out to fire up their base because they refuse to develop an agenda that would allow them to compete in the real world. So they don't compete in the real world. And of course, they've created this media bubble to advance whatever nonsense they're peddling. It's reckless. And it certainly touches on what we're going to talk about on this week's show. So let's get to that. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Paul Waldman. Stay tuned. When we met, you thought that I could probably change. I warned you then that, baby, I don't seem insane, but I fucking am. And I'm rocking a little gold chain that ain't real gold. I told you it's fucking fake. I spend my money elsewhere. That come in little plastic bags and they disappear the same night. The same night. I ain't your average normal dude, it's sure ain't glamorous. I keep things loose, I ain't your average punk rock loser, yeah, I'm a savage. I'm really cool. Try to warn you, I'm loose. Welcome back. I'm always happy to have our next guest on the show. Paul Waldman writes about politics for the Washington Post. Paul, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
It is great to be back with you.
It's always great to have you. So the early days of the Republican-led House of Representatives has been even more of a shit show than I expected, which is kind of impressive, as I did not have high hopes. So we had the spectacle of the kind of somewhat mild-mannered, normally mild-mannered Alabama Republican Mike Rogers being physically restrained as he tried to deck Matt Gaetz. Two members of the QAnon squad, Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, are fighting in the ladies' room off of the speaker's lobby. Greene and Gaetz are also reportedly not talking to each other. Greene has been the subject of MAGA attacks, which is very bizarre. 10 Republicans have called for the serial liar George Santos, or whatever his real name is, to resign from Congress for fabricating his entire biography. You have Florida Republican Vern Buchanan, who has been in the House for over a decade, confronting Kevin McCarthy on the speaker's floor for, and I quote, fucking him by giving the gavel to the all-powerful Ways and Means Committee, which Buchanan had been expecting to one of the holdouts who opposed McCarthy's bid for speaker, Representative Jason Smith. He gave Smith the chairmanship of Ways and Means to flip his vote. That is a pattern that we've seen developing, with McCarthy supporters expressing frustration with the secret deal McCarthy cut with the crazy caucus. All of this, of course, is happening as we get into what is shaping up to be a contested GOP primary. So Republicans are in quite a bit of disarray. Paul, I wanted to ask you how these very public, messy divides might impact the next 2 years of divided government. Like all these people share a desire to own the libs. They all consume the same media. They tend to share similar ideological assumptions. So what is the difference, given that Republicans hold the House, but not the Senate or the White House, between a unified caucus and one that is like at each other's throats?
Well, it's hard to predict at this point exactly how it's going to play out. I mean, the best model we have is probably what happened during the Obama administration after the Republicans took control of the House in 2010. And I think that in some ways that may be weighing on these current Republicans' minds in a way that is maybe making them almost sort of pre-frustrated. Because what we saw at that time, the dynamic was that, you know, they made all these promises to their base. And the people who were in charge at the time, people like John Boehner, weren't really comfortable with the Tea Party uprising and these newly radical base Republican voters. You know, that generation who was in charge, they were people who were kind of old school Republicans, you know, backroom dealers and such, who, you know, thought you could sit down and get some things done, even though they were quite conservative.
Yes.
You still had this wave of people who were coming in, who were more radical and more willing. You know, the Tea Party caucus was kind of the precursor of what's now the Freedom Caucus. They were not really comfortable with this uprising coming up from below. And they had made all these promises, the party as a whole had, that, you know, once we get control of the House, we're going to repeal Obamacare and we're going to, you know, basically make it so that we just roll back the last couple of years and this nightmare of this man being in the White House, Barack Obama, will essentially be wiped away. And they couldn't do it, of course. With one control of one House of Congress, there's only so much you can accomplish. And what happened was that their base got increasingly kind of frustrated and angry. They say they became to view their Republican representatives as ineffectual and feckless. They couldn't get anything done. And that led to, primary challenges and a whole lot of just kind of dissatisfaction that ultimately was expressed in the election of Donald Trump. Right. That, you know, he was somebody who could come along and say, like, I don't have anything to do with these losers, and that's why you should elect me. And, you know, the Republican Party rallied around him. So I think that there may be a degree to which that's sort of in the back of the minds of the Republicans in the House. You know, they're already mad. They've barely started, and they're already they're mad at each other. They can't. They're not sure if they can accomplish what they want to, and they're not even sure what exactly they want to accomplish. You know, I think there are some less crazy representatives who don't really like the idea of trying to replay those debt ceiling showdowns that we had in 2011 and I guess it was 2013, where they lost those confrontations in the end. I mean, there were ways in which what came out of it was unnecessary budget cuts, but politically it was very bad for them. And this time it could be even worse. I think that as a starting point, the Democrats are much less willing to do what Obama did and negotiate. You know, I would hope that they can hold to this line, but their current position is we're not going to negotiate about this. We just have to raise the debt ceiling. And we're not going to trade away anything for you, you know, holding a gun to the head of the American economy and then saying you'll take it away if we give you a bunch of budget cuts. So that's the position the Democrats are taking now. But so on the one hand, they're more resolved than the Democrats were back in 2011 and that the Obama administration was. On the other hand, the Republicans are even crazier now than they were then. And some of them are even more willing to, you know, cause real economic harm and destruction in order to get what they want. So it's hard to know exactly how that's going to play out. You know, what happens when we come in a few months to the point where, you know, there are no more, excuse me, extraordinary measures that the Treasury Department can take that we really have to pass a debt limit. When we get to that crisis point, it could go either way. You know, the administration could buckle and say, okay, we'll accept certain budget cuts. Yeah. Or you could find a few less crazy Republicans who are willing to vote with Democrats and just increase the debt ceiling. But nobody really knows. And I think that uncertainty is driving a lot of this kind of anger, is that the really conservative Republicans who managed to force some of these concessions out of McCarthy, they are feeling their power, but they're not sure they really have it. You know, like they got some committee assignments and he has said that he's going to try to force these budget cuts, but nobody trusts Kevin McCarthy. You know, they don't trust him as a matter of keeping his word, but they also don't trust him just to be able to deliver. You know, he's not someone, a leader like Mitch McConnell or like Nancy Pelosi, who can actually like put together the votes and do what he's trying to do.
Right.
You know,
he is an invertebrate. I mean, this is the biggest question we're facing, is whether these nut jobs in the House are really going to push the U.S. into a default on its debt. And I should note that defaulting would almost certainly result in a crushing global recession. We should always remember that that is the stake here. I would also note that almost a quarter of the federal deficit, 23%, was racked up in the 4 years that Trump was president, two of which were with unified Republican control of government. And I wonder if the House Republican caucus's extremism, at least the rump, might actually make it easier for McCarthy to maneuver around them, maybe with, say, 20 Democratic votes. The question is, if he did that, would he survive as Speaker? Because they insisted on getting this mechanism where any one member of the Republican caucus can basically force a vote of no confidence. As you mentioned, Paul, Democrats don't want to bail McCarthy out. They have enjoyed watching him twist in the wind, but they are serious about governing. So at some point, one would think they would do what needs to be done to avert a catastrophe if it's just a matter of, you know, some modest concessions. Obviously, they're not going to give up Social Security and Medicare, which is what some of these guys are asking for. What do you think about this, the sustainability of this strategy that the White House is just saying, we're just not going to negotiate? And that seems to me to be something that is, it looks like they've learned some lessons from 2010 and 2013, or 2011 and 2013, after winning those. They actually lost House seats in the 2012 election, but they still had a majority. What do you think about that? Is it sustainable?
So, I mean, you can carry it all the way until the end. You know, if they want to make a last minute adjustment and say, okay, you know, we'll give you a little bit of sort of symbolic budget cuts here and there, and do that at the 11th hour, you know, they will probably be able to get away with that. But I think that one of the things they understand, well, let's say two things. The first is that from a substantive point of view, it was really terrible that in the Obama years, they agreed to the sequester, which, you know, took these huge budget cuts out of a lot of different areas of the government. And they're they understand now that that was that that led to a lot of unnecessary cutting and pain, and that there's no benefit to going down a road that produces something like that, even though that's what Republicans, many Republicans would want. But then as a political matter, I think that they believe that they're ultimately on the right side on this, that it's not hard to convince people that causing a recession is going to be really bad. And, you know, if you just the more that they stick to their guns and just say we don't negotiate with terrorists, the more clear it will become to the public, and eventually the costs, the political costs to Republicans will keep going up and up as we approach the moment of catastrophe.
It's the classic placing the dead cat on your opponent's doorstep.
Yeah. So I think that, as I said, I think that, you know, maybe in the end, they might be able to say, all right, you know, we'll give you a little something and help you save face a little bit. And then you'll be able to say, oh, we extracted this concession, as long as it's not too painful. And they can do that at the last minute and then be able to say, you know, we just gave them a little something and we saved the country from their recklessness. And you might be able to arrive at some kind of a situation where the Democrats can get what they want and Republicans can maybe save face a little bit, but probably not all that much. You know, again, turn back at the Obama years, like there was always a point where John Boehner would say, like, enough, you know, we've lost this one and we just have to give in. Now, Kevin McCarthy can't really say that because he doesn't have any cushion in votes. And, you know, he could lose a speakership at a moment's notice if they can come up with an alternative. That's so, so that makes it a little more complicated, but it also means that you could peel off, you know, a couple of Republicans, maybe if they had to do, if, you know, they could increase the debt ceiling with a discharge petition, but that's a long involved process that would take like a month or two to actually play out. I mean, I think that there ought to be more people out there making a case for the unilateral alternatives that the administration could use. The first is, you know, what people call the $1 trillion coin, which is just having the Treasury mint enough money to account for all the bills that have to be paid. There's also the 14th Amendment option. The 14th Amendment says that that the debt of the United States shall not be questioned. And so there are, you know, very well-informed legal scholars who think that that itself makes the debt limit unconstitutional. And there's no reason why the White House couldn't just say, you know, we have consulted with our lawyers and they have informed us that the debt limit is unconstitutional. And therefore, we are going to order the Treasury to keep paying America's bills. Yeah. And if Republicans want to sue to stop us from doing that and to force a recession, then they can go ahead and we'll see how that goes. Yeah. And then Republicans would have to do it. You know, there'd be some question of whether they have standing. There could be a whole legal process. Ultimately, it would end up in the Supreme Court. But in the short term, I think that might be the best option for the White House. Now, yeah. I don't think they're going to do it because Democrats are very skittish about doing anything that is not the way things have been done.
Yes.
You know, there's this real feeling. This is something that, you know, Republicans are always very happy to be as creative as possible and to say, you know, oh, you know, nobody tried filibustering everything before. Well, let's just do it. See how it goes. They're very, you know, they're very creative and open-minded when it comes to things like that. Democrats are very, you know, they're terribly worried that someone will, you know, pen a stern editorial in a newspaper like mine if they do something that hasn't been done before. It's not in the accepted norms. But there's no reason why they couldn't. And just, as I said, just said, you know, let's see how this goes. This is the position we're going to take. We're going to keep paying the bills and go ahead and sue us. And maybe we'll lose in the Supreme Court. Who knows?
You know what? I think they should mint the $1 trillion coin and put Trump's face on it and then be like, look, are you really against making America great again? We're making the Trump coin. We're going to fix this problem and stave off recession with the Trump coin. That's my thought. So I think that this internal divide, this intra-party, and it's not really ideological, it's more strategic, is going to be a defining factor over the next couple of years. So I have a similar question about the Senate and the House, right? There again, you have this big strategic divide between apparent strategic divide between Kevin McCarthy and his caucus, Senate Republican leader and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who is obviously in the minority. It was hard to escape the symbolism, by the way, of Kevin McCarthy going through vote after vote after vote in an effort to win the speakership over the objections of the, you know, wing nuttiest members of his caucus, while Mitch McConnell appeared in an event with Joe Biden and both Republican and Democratic governors to tout the benefits of the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed the Senate with, I think it was 18 or 19 Republican votes. So my question is similar. How might having at least a dozen or so Republicans in the Senate who seem relatively serious about governing, as well as a Senate minority leader who seems serious about governing, how does that impact, or how might that impact, the House's effectiveness in advancing its agenda, hobbling the Biden administration, forcing crazy spending cuts, etc.?
Yeah, the dynamics do tend to be different. You know, senators have to get elected statewide. There are certainly some crazy right-wing senators, but there are not as many of them. And they, you know, are required, at least many of them, if not most of them, to have something of a view to what can appeal to the middle of the electorate that I have to appeal to. There's a desire that many of them have, you know, that event with McConnell is a great example, to actually, you know, bring home the bacon, the things that we, the kind of things that we used to think that members of Congress were supposed to do, to actually give their constituents something tangible. And so I think when it comes down to these showdowns, what McConnell seems to have shown lately is that he is much more selective about picking and choosing his fights. I think we've seen that over the last 2 years, that, you know, he had this strategy in the Obama years of total and complete opposition, based on the idea that anything bad that happened would get blamed on the president. And if he could just muck things up as much as possible, that would be good for Republicans. And to a great extent, he was right, but he kind of shifted his strategy in the last 2 years. He did that a lot, but he also, from time to time, and this was true of other Republicans in the Senate as well, would be willing to negotiate and pass some kind of a bipartisan bill. You know, we had the infrastructure bill. We had a bill on some very modest gun control. There were a few things like that that passed with McConnell, sometimes his votes and always his assent. And there were a group of people, some of whom have retired now, people like Roy Blunt from Missouri and Rob Portman from Ohio, who have left, who were willing to go along with Democrats and, you know, try to find some kind of common solution when they thought there was a good reason to do it. There may be a fewer of them, but there's still quite a few of those people in the Senate. And what it does is, I think it just sort of takes the Senate out of the equation to a great degree, because, you know, we're not talking about any kind of real meaningful legislation on anything that's remotely contentious. You know, they'll still rename post offices and stuff like that, and, you know, fund the military and things of that nature. But they're not going to be any kind of ambitious legislation in the next 2 years, because Republicans have control in the House. And so to a great extent, it just means that the Senate is not really the point anymore. And if all they're trying to do is to keep the doors open for government, then McConnell will go along with that. He doesn't seem to think that the kind of showdowns that we've seen before over things like the debt ceiling are in his party's interest. And he's right about that. I mean, if you look at what happened in 2022, the biggest problem they had, the biggest reason that Democrats had a fairly successful election, was the widespread perception that Republicans were radical, that they were crazy, that they couldn't be trusted. And I think McConnell is very attuned to that. He knows that that's a problem for their party, and it's more a problem for his members than it is for, you know, some member of the House whose district votes 80% Republican. So, and he knows that that perception is a problem for whoever their presidential nominee is. And he would like to have a Republican elected president. And the more that they're perceived as a party of radicals who just want to tear everything down, the harder it's going to be for a Republican to be elected president, the harder it's going to be for him to take control of the Senate back, which is, you know, very much in play in 2024. And so I think McConnell's perspective is he's just, things are just going to be quiet over in his chamber, and he will, you know, the administration doesn't really need his help. And because there's not going to be anything that, you know, is really going to require a filibuster, the battles are just going to be about, are we going to keep the lights on in government? And that's going to be determined by what happens in the House.
I think that having the Senate Republican caucus not on board with the hostage taking in the House increases political pressure on members of the House to be responsible and govern. If they can say, well, look, you know, whatever we do here, it's not going to get past, you know, a filibuster in the Senate. That's different from, you know, having Republican senators say, I urge my colleagues in the House to get their shit together, which is likely to happen in the next couple of years. Paul, one last question. I know I'm keeping you a little longer than I said. You live in D.C. You've long been a sharp-eyed critic of the Beltway Press. Do you think the ostensibly neutral media is continuing to whitewash Republican extremism and unseriousness, similar to the way that they did during the Tea Party craziness of the Obama years? And you'll remember, the press used to pretend that the Tea Partiers were like these independent voters who had substantive concerns about federal spending, right? Or do you think that they are getting better, that is the mainstream press, at accurately portraying kind of the degree of dysfunction this conspiracy-driven movement is creating in Congress?
I do think it's harder for them to take seriously Republican claims about the budget and about deficits.
And about documents.
The Democrats have been saying forever that, you know, Democrats have been saying forever that Republicans don't really mean it when they say they care about the deficit. They're perfectly happy to run deficits up when there's a Republican president. But after so many iterations of that cycle where, you know, they say, oh, the deficit is an emergency when there's a Democrat in the White House. And then when there's a Republican in the White House, they cut taxes and stop talking about the deficit. We've been through that so many times. I think it to a degree, it finally has sunk in. And they're much more skeptical of the Republican claim that this is something that they really care about. So I think that there's some progress on that. There's always that kind of gravitational tug back to the sort of both sides-ism.
Yeah.
I think you're seeing that now with the way that the Biden classified document story is being handled.
Yes.
That there's a real desire to say that, you know, this is very similar to what to pair every bit of news about it with Trump and make an equivalence there.
Yeah.
And to kind of exaggerate its importance. The whole questions are being raised thing. It's all, yes, a lot of passive voice, a lot of justification by, you know, we have to treat this like a big story because people are treating it like a big story. And I think that, you know, there's always, you always see that kind of that sort of swing of the pendulum where if there's too much bad news for Republicans, reporters will feel a need to like find some bad news with Democrats or exaggerate the bad news when it happens to, yes, show how objective they're being.
That's right.
And so I think we are seeing some of that now. But you know, it's a constant battle to keep the press focused on what's really important and on putting it in the terms that are the most, you know, the most accurate and the most contextualized. That's a battle that's never going to be won completely. But I think there are some reasons to think that some of those stories are being portrayed a little more accurately than they might have been in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I, you know, as I mentioned last week, I don't believe that there is an editor or a reporter in this entire country who actually believes that those stories are similar. But they are desperate for some drama. It's been a very quiet, undramatic White House for the first 2 years, and they're just desperate for it. And I think that story is going to get dumber and dumber until an imminent default on the national debt provides a shiny object to distract everybody. Paul Waldman, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me this week.
It is my pleasure as always.
Folks, speaking of extremism and right-wing governance, we're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Aaron Reed, who's been tracking the onslaught of legislation targeting transgender people. Stay tuned.
can see it all on your face. You're feeling crowded. Why don't we find a better place? 'Cause I think we're surrounded by people with these first world problems, trying to fix those people with those third world problems. People with those third world problems, laughing at the people with those first world problems. Let's get out of here. Ooh, that's better. Ooh, roll my window down. Ooh, that's better. Damn, I'm out of cigarettes. Move in here and let's fill her up. You rock the pumps and I'll stand in line. The locals here are ready to jump, whispering the gossip of a in-house kind. People with those small town problems, look at all these people with these small town problems. People with the whole sheep problem, laughing at the cackle of the small town problems. Let's get out of here. Ooh, that's better.
Welcome back. I am still Joshua Holland. And look, in 2023, as in past years, we're going to focus quite a bit on the rights targeting of transgender people and the LGBT community more broadly in both state houses and in the streets. And we do this both because it's such an important story and also because history tells us that when we don't stand up against fascist attacks on vulnerable groups, it just emboldens them to go after others that they deem to be enemies. Anyway, my next guest has been tracking these legislative efforts closely. Erin Reed also covers repro rights and writes about trans and queer history on her Substack, which is called Erin in the Morn, all one word, and on her TikTok channel, which is also Erin in the Morn. Erin Reed, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. So I wanted to ask you a question before we get into the legislative assault we're seeing in red states. The Atlantic has a piece this week titled Take Detransitioners Seriously. And I'll be honest that I didn't read this piece because this is a publication that does not take transgender people's experience at all seriously. And they have run a zillion pieces over the past 5 years scaring people about various aspects of transgender people's lives. And here's my question. The Atlantic is not Breitbart. It is not The Federalist. It is not Fox News. Its audience is, I think, you know, well-educated liberals and, you know, centrist, moderate conservatives. I wanted to ask you, to what degree do you think the sort of person who doesn't pay close attention to these issues and sees stuff like that in the Atlantic, to what degree do you think that helps shape public perception around these issues?
I definitely think that media has a role to play in how public perception works around transgender people. And I have read the Atlantic article. I'm familiar with the authors. I'm familiar with the people that appear in the article itself. We have seen in recent months an increase in journalism that seeks to both sides transgender people's lives and experiences.
Right.
You know, we've seen this in the New York Times and Reuters as well. Stories that focus on things like puberty blockers and healthcare and trans youth. The issue that I have is that yes, they are these publications do tend to be moderate, centrist, even read by some liberals. However, they are primarily cisgender guided and directed, and so few transgender reporters get to have that voice and that platform. The people that are often writing about our lives and our experiences are people that either don't have experience being trans or play into stereotypes that cisgender people have about transgender people. You know, the article itself in The Atlantic about detransitioners unfortunately presents detransitioners as something that is common, something that is to be avoided. And in reality, you know, I know detransitioners. I've got multiple detransitioner friends. And these people often detransition, not because they aren't trans, but because they're facing incredible consequences in their lives from their family, from their peers, from their coworkers, for being out as transgender. And those are the voices that so rarely don't get platformed, the people that are forced to stay in the closet, the people that are forced back into the closet, which is precisely what all of these anti-LGBTQ bills that we're going to be talking about seek to do.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we did a segment on the trans panic, I would call it, a few months back. And we talked about how there was this massive shift in public opinion about gay rights starting in the late 1990s or so. I'm not sure exactly when, maybe the mid 90s. And it was largely a result of lots of people coming out that made it harder for straight people to hold on to negative stereotypes about gays and lesbians, because suddenly it wasn't, you know, this abstract idea. It was Bob down at the tire store, right? And Bob is a normal, decent guy, so maybe those stereotypes aren't accurate. And I, just speaking to what you were just saying, it seems to me that a problem that we have now is that transgender people are under constant threat of harassment and violence, and that makes it harder to come out to the world. And I've encountered, even in my own circle, a number of people who are not bigots, right? Not necessarily transphobic, but they just don't get it because they haven't been exposed to transgender people and their lives. And I want to make the point that I always do, that there is no debate here. There is absolutely no debate. There are people who are trying to live their lives and to the best of their ability, and there are people who are hostile towards them. Anyway, I'm sorry for the tangents. My bad. I invited you on to talk about the state of legislation, right? So let's do that. And it's not just that this legislation we're seeing is designed to punish transgender people alone. It is more encompassing, and it often targets their support networks, familial networks, et cetera, in red states. And folks, Erin has a very informative post at her Substack. Again, you can find that at erininthemorning.substack. And it has a map and accompanying summaries of like legislation across the country. So it gives you a very good bird's eye view. Erin, looking at your map, I see there are six states representing like a good chunk of the old Confederacy where transgender people face the greatest degree of risk from their governments. And this does not include risks of being attacked by like fascist Proud Boys or whatever. Mm-hmm. There are another 13 where your analysis suggests there is a high risk of anti-trans legislation becoming law in the next 2 years. Before we get into what some of this legislation looks like, and folks, some of it is like downright evil, I wanted to ask you how your map has changed over time and how it changed or didn't change with the 2022 midterm elections.
Yeah, you know, so this map has been something that I've maintained for a few months now because people were asking me, I live in such and such state. What can I do? Where can I go? Where is the closest place that I can flee to escape these laws that are targeting me? And I had to answer that question to so many people so many times. I was getting it multiple times a day even. And so rather than try to explain through each person's individual circumstances, I formulated this map to help people with that decision-making. Because some people can't flee from Florida all the way to the nearest super safe state like Illinois. And so maybe they might look at a state like Georgia, which is at moderate risk for passing anti-trans laws, but which has not seen the same appetite as Texas, Arkansas, Alabama. And they might decide that Georgia is a more feasible option for them to flee to. Right. You know, I looked at the election results, and I will say that the map improved after the election for transgender people. We saw states like Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, all of those states saw anti-trans candidates and anti-trans policies fail at the state level, as well as governorships and other issues around them. And so being able to mark those states as somewhat safer post-election was very, you know, very cathartic for me. I was very happy to see that. However, yeah. I am seeing now in the legislative cycle, which is just gotten up and running and it is already at full blast. I am seeing that many of the states that did not improve are going even further into the anti-trans pipeline in terms of the bills that they're putting forward. And I am seeing some of the most cruel and extreme bills that I've ever seen targeting the trans community right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about some of those. And by the way, this speaks to what Aaron was just saying about how the map changed for the better in some states in the 2022 midterms. This just gets to what I'm always saying, which is that, you know, we always focus, relentlessly on federal elections. You got to look at the state legislative races. You got to look at the state judicial races. Those things are super, super important, and they affect how, you know, how things are where we live. So we have first a spate of anti-drag laws being considered in red states. Transgender people are obviously not in drag, but these bills are being used to target both drag queens and transgender people, right?
Yes, and so I'm glad that you brought this up because this is something that I have actually been very involved in tracking both yesterday and today. Yesterday, I was actually in the middle of a media interview when immediately in the middle of the interview, a new anti-drag law was proposed in West Virginia. And this bill actually was the most extreme anti-drag law that I had ever seen. And I even want to avoid calling it an anti-drag law because in particular, this bill was also directly an anti-trans law. The law read that transgender and transvestite exposure to minors would be considered obscene matters punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And so this is just mere exposure, and it actually specifically is the first ban to use the word transgender exposure. And so what does that mean for transgender teachers? What does that mean for transgender parents? I'm a transgender parent. I have a young child who I walk to school, to and from school every day. And I see laws like this, and I imagine how they might criminalize my existence. You know, I often do visit West Virginia. West Virginia is a beautiful state with amazing natural beauty. And I go hiking there sometimes, and I go there with my son sometimes. And if this bill passes, I personally would feel too afraid to travel through the state. It would be an area of the country that would be blocked off to me. Never mind the people that are actually living there. We've got six other states right now that are also proposing drag bans that also could be read to target the transgender community as well. Arizona, Oklahoma, Montana, Arkansas just passed the first one out of committee unanimously in Arkansas, and it will go for a vote on the full Senate floor. That just happened an hour ago. And so, yeah, we are seeing drag bills targeted at the trans community.
And this would, what is the punishment that's being proposed here?
It depends on the state. In West Virginia, the one that I was just talking about, it defines it as distributing obscene matters to minors, which is almost like distributing pornography to minors. That is up to a 5-year prison sentence and $25,000 fine. In Arkansas, I'm not sure what the enforcement mechanism is there. Some of these states have misdemeanors. Some of the states have fines that are centered around like business fines. Like you have to register as a sexually oriented business, or then you get hit with fines for not doing that. And so, yeah, you know, there are a variety of ways that they're trying to enforce these bans, but all in all, they are designed to target gender nonconformity, essentially.
Yeah. And yeah, there's, I think there's a risk here. There is a tendency to highlight where these bills have a spillover effect and end up hurting, you know, people who are just gender cisgender people who are, you know, butch women and the like. And I think we have to be careful to focus on who these things are actually targeted towards, even though there may be collateral damage. These are anti-trans bills specifically. My oldest and arguably my best friend has a kid who is gender fluid, may transition when he gets a bit older. That will, of course, be his decision. So this next one hits kind of close to home. You wrote last week about these new bills Let me quote. You write, in the wake of gender-affirming healthcare bans that are spreading across red states, an even more inhumane bill has begun to take root, bills that charge parents with child abuse for trans care. Erin, what fresh hell are you talking about here?
Yeah, so this is inspired by an action that was taken in Texas in February of 2022. In Texas, they tried in 2021 to define gender-affirming care for trans youth as being illegal, and they also had talk about making it a form of child abuse. That failed in the Texas legislature, the deeply red Texas legislature in 2021. So in 2022, Governor Greg Abbott decides to interpret existing child abuse statutes as also applying to gender-affirming care, basically reading into the law something that did not exist. Gender-affirming care is not banned under any sort of child abuse statute in Texas. So he's giving like a very broad reading. And so he directed all Child Protective Services agents in the state, as well as all mandatory reporters. So we're talking teachers, doctors, nurses.
Right.
He directed that everybody had to report the parents of transgender youth who they believed were obtaining gender-affirming care for child abuse. And we saw a massive investigation of trans parents throughout the state of Texas. This got held up in court because there is no Texas law that states that gender-affirming care is child abuse. So fast forward, and now we're looking at the 2023 legislative session. A number of legislators have taken Greg Abbott's example and sought to codify gender-affirming care as child abuse within the law explicitly. So we're talking about Missouri, Texas, Mississippi, Wyoming, and then also Indiana. And Indiana is a particularly vile bill, the one that has dropped in Indiana, because that bill actually says that gender-affirming care is going to be banned under conversion therapy laws, basically saying that getting gender-affirming care is a form of conversion therapy that is also tantamount to other forms of torture, like ice baths and nails under nails through your skin. Like literally these are in the bill, and it defines gender-affirming care alongside those, and then also defines that it is child abuse punishable by years in prison. So these laws would take affirmed, loved trans kids from their parents, place them into the state, jail the parents, likely also take away the cisgender kids because that's how child abuse services work, all because a parent is following the best medical guidelines and taking care of their trans youth.
Yeah. Three states run by limited government conservatives, the kind who rail against forcing people to wear masks on public transit during a pandemic, are considering bills that would actually force people, and not just children, not just children. I really want to emphasize that. To detransition. Can you talk a little bit about these?
Of course. So the states that I'm watching are Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, and also South Carolina. So actually we're at four right now. And these bills would basically force the withdrawal of gender-affirming care for trans people, including some adults. In Oklahoma and South Carolina, for instance, the bill goes up to 26 years of age. And what happens whenever you make gender-affirming care illegal for people that are already on gender-affirming care, it means that they then have to withdraw from that care. They remove their hormones. They remove all of the medication that essentially allows a transgender person to medically transition. And whenever people speak about the irreversible nature, quote unquote, of being trans, they completely ignore the fact that there are many things about gender-affirming care that are indeed reversible. And you very quickly learn that whenever you are forced to withdraw from it.
Right.
So we what I'm talking about here are that transgender women, for instance, if you pull them from estrogen and you remove their hormones, they will then start to regrow facial hair and they will face masculinization. If you take a transgender man and you withdraw him from testosterone, he will return to having periods and experiencing other things about the hormones that are present in his body as a result of being withdrawn from testosterone.
Right.
And so these bills do force medical detransition. They force somebody to undergo what is called medical detransition, and that is the withdrawal of gender-affirming care and a resumption of previous biological processes.
This is all a result of not being able to make political traction any longer out of mere hostility towards gays and lesbians. I mean, if you look at the big picture. Aaron, before I let you go, I want to ask you a question that you may not have an answer to. I don't know. There have been anecdotal stories of transgender people or families with transgender kids fleeing some of these states. You mentioned it earlier because they feel that the threat level is intolerable. Do you have a sense of how common that is, or if it's becoming more common as this assault ramps up? What is your thoughts on this question?
Yeah, so there's sort of two answers to this. The first answer is that, yes, people are fleeing these states, and it is becoming more common, trans youth as well as trans adults. And I've spoken personally to some. I've helped some escape. I've raised money for some that were fleeing Texas during the child abuse investigations, for instance. On the other hand, Texas, according to any data on the prevalence of being trans, probably has over 100,000 trans youth. And there is no way that all of them have the income and the ability to flee Texas.
Right.
And so there are people that will be stuck by virtue of their economic circumstances in these states by the states that are targeting them.
Yes.
And it's those people that I really fear for.
And there's economic circumstances. There are also non-economic factors that ground us to the places we live, you know, social networks, family connections, et cetera, jobs.
Absolutely. Aaron Reed,
I believe we are about out of time. I would love to have you back on occasionally to keep our listeners up to speed with what's happening out there.
Of course, anytime.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
You too. Thank you for having me.
I would also like to thank Paul Waldman and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Mastodon at present. It's probably where I'm doing most of my social media posting. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.